The Hunger But Mainly Death Games, A Parody by Bretness Everclean. Narrated by Ariel Delisle. Copyright 2011 by Bretness Everclean. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with John Bailey Owen and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. 1. When I wake up, my side of the trash heap is cold. My quilt is missing. I lie there in the dark, rubbing my eyes, trying to think of where it could have gone. I hope it didn't disintegrate, I think. After all, it's only some pieces of wet newspaper. I reach out through the gloom and find my answer. Pigrose, the disgusting little street urchin, has stolen it from me. Pigrose is also my beautiful little sister. As I lie here, shivering in the cold, I am left with one thought. Could life get any worse? Actually, it could. Because all of a sudden, I remember that today is no ordinary day. Today could end my existence altogether. Yes, that's right. Today is the first day of school. Oh, and it's also reaming day, when kids between the ages of 12 and 18 are chosen to participate in the Hunger But Mainly Death Games, which, as you might expect from the name, is a tournament in which they fight to the death and occasionally experience hunger. The children picked are called sacrifices, and they are almost guaranteed to die in an excruciating manner. But the reaming isn't till this afternoon. On a day like this, you've got to take things one at a time. Besides, I'm sure I'll never get picked. But with all of this on my mind, I'm also sure that I won't be falling back asleep. I clamber out of bed, rubbing the sleep and trash out of my eyes as I stretch my toes in the glass-filled mud floor. I glance over at Pig, who slumbers on peacefully. Pig is 12. In our world, that's considered old enough. Old enough to starve to death, to kill and to be killed. It's also old enough to see R-rated movies, so it's not all bad, I guess. But Pig is my little sister, and some part of me will always see her as a baby. I let her slumber on and try to imagine what she's dreaming of. A warm bottle of formula, a new toy for bath time, a bright wooden block to bang up and down on the tray of her high chair. The inner workings of her baby mind elude me. Across the room, I can make out my mother's body curled up on a pile of old styrofoam and greasy shirts. Fitting, the way she's claimed the best bed in the house for herself. Perhaps I should cut her some slack. She is my mother, after all. Then again, she's tried to bury me alive more times than I can count. I stumble toward the shower and turn it on. When it's warm, I step in, trying to collect my thoughts as the garbage juice splashes over my long brown hair. There's an old saying we have about the garbage juice here. It won't get you clean, but it probably won't make you any dirtier, and it might even knock off some of the old dry trash that's stuck on you. That's how things are in our region of Slum 12, known to most as the crack. Slum 12 is our nation's landfill, and the crack is its most disgusting region. Anytime there's a piece of trash that's deemed too gross to even be put in a landfill, it's smushed over into the crack. When I go downstairs, I see that Pig has left a present for me by the door. How sweet, I think, tearing off the bow. My jaw drops in horror as soon as I see what's inside. It's cheese from Acid Barf, the revolting and dangerous creature Pig refers to as her cat. The cheese that dribbles from his 400-pound body actually paints an accurate portrait of the creature himself, pitch black, oozing, and filled with semi-digested maggots. I'm repulsed by it, but I can't bring myself to tell Pig that. She loves Acid Barf too much. I'll never forget the day she brought him home. I was out front sweeping our dirt, when I looked up and saw Pig skipping towards me, an unmistakably evil creature bounding towards her, about to tear her to shreds. "Pig, run!" I shouted. "Monster!"
"Don't be silly," she called out. "This is my kitty."
"That is not a cat, Pig! That is not a cat!"
"Look, he's kissing." kissing me," she exclaimed,
as he batted her down and trapped her in his claws.
"He's such a darling little owl fellow."
I wasn't pleased by the thought of having another mouth to feed, and my body was already crawling with the ticks that dropped off Acid Barf's fur like dandruff. But when I looked into Pig's pleading eyes, I knew I couldn't disappoint her. And, to her credit, she somehow convinced Acid Barf not to eat us. For our part, we pretend not to notice every time he drags the skinned corpse of a neighbor to our doorstep. Burying his kills in shallow graves and not being eaten by him, this is the closest we will ever come to love. Which, from what I can tell, is how all relationships work, more or less. Here in the present, the misery of my situation rushes back to me. I don't want to go to school. Why do I even have to? Only a government as unjust as ours, which makes its own teenagers murder each other on national television, could cook up such a cruel form of torture. In some ways, I'd almost rather get stuck in the death tournament than sit through another school year. But we all know that's never going to happen. I step outside and gently shut the door, an egg carton and a rubber band, behind me. Without warning, I get the feeling that this will be the last time I see my home. And then I remember. Every morning after I leave home, we move to a new home. That's because our homes are actually piles of trash that either blow away in the wind or get picked up by the sanitation department, which for some reason exists in our town made out of garbage. It's still a bit early, so I take my time and stroll through the streets. I pass the homes of the crack's least fortunate, who are so poor that they must spend their entire lives in used graves. I pass the crack's sole restaurant, a Little Caesar's. A shiver runs down my spine. When I come to the entrance of the trash mines, I pause for a moment. Trash mining is the only way of life for most in Slum 12. It's hard work, and it can often be humiliating, since the mines also function as the entire nation's sewer system. This is bad enough in itself, but the government makes things even worse by forcing every worker to wear humiliating signs on their chests. "I love duty," runs a common one. Another, "Today, my breakfast was a duty." A third, "Stay out of my mouth. Precious duty treasures inside for me to munch on later." But if you're a diligent worker, you can make something of yourself. Maybe your supervisor will notice you and give you some of those plastic rings that hold soda cans, or an old hunk of mayonnaise that's turned hard. My father was one of the best trash miners, or so I'm told. When he proposed to my mother, he was able to give her an engagement ring with one of the biggest mayonnaise emeralds the crack had ever seen. But if my father's story illustrates the glitz and glamour of trash mining, it also shows just how dangerous it can be. I'll never forget the day he was swept away in an underground poop river. The currents were so fast that not even his life preserver diaper could save him. I'm headed to the woods that surround the crack right now. We call them the tires because, well, that's what they are. Stacks upon stacks of old tires, in a magnificent array of sizes and types and states of housing rattlesnake families. I tread lightly as I near the electric fence meant to keep us out. We are told the tires are too dangerous for teenagers. They were closed off a few years ago after some kids found a stash of old fireworks and burned their hands a little while setting them off. You wouldn't expect a government like ours to lose sleep over their subjects' day-to-day safety, would you? But it's another example of their infinite evil. They want to make sure that teens don't get to kill each other the ways they naturally enjoy, like playing with things that explode and driving cars fast. I've come to the tires this morning in search of Greta. Greta is my best friend and closest confidant. We look like siblings, what with our dark coloring and thick unibrows, and we act like the kind of siblings who are secretly dating, or, as they like to call themselves, twins. Except that Greta and I are not in love. Not by a long shot. What? Why are you looking at me like that? You think I don't know whether or not I'm in love with someone? Come on. Emotions and dating stuff can be pretty confusing, but give me credit when it comes to knowing my own mind, And it's not like every guy you're close with has to be a potential love interest. Besides, Greta is great, but he's a little extremely moody. Take my birthday last year. At the stroke of midnight, he appeared at my door.
I wrote this poem for you,
he said, shoving a piece of crumpled paper into my hands.
The world must burn, lava exploding into faces. Their skeletons are screaming now. No survivors. From Greta.
Oh, wow, I began.
Don't bother thanking me, he said. I just wanted to comfort you for being 1 year closer to the grave. Of course, I failed miserably, because comfort doesn't exist in this universe.
Thanks all the same, I said. See you at the fort? That fort is where I'm headed now. Greta goes there whenever he wants to think or melt action figures. When I reach the ramshackle gate he's erected around it, I nod at the Greta's sentry and let myself in. It was a fun day when we found that cave with all the old skeletons. When I come across Greta, he's hunched over something. Hey, Greta, what you doing? He spins around in surprise.
Bratness,
he sputters, a brief flash of anger flickering across his eyes.
How many times have I told you not to question me about my dark experiments?
It looks to me like you're banging on some batteries with rocks.
I wanted to see what was inside, he says. Well, come on in, if you dare.
I take a seat on a shower curtain, while Greta paces restlessly back and forth. Something wrong? I ask.
Not really, he says. Other than the fact that for all I know, I'll be condemned to an excruciatingly painful death in just a few hours.
I stare at him blankly.
Because I'll get picked to be in that death tournament?
I shake my head. Still nothing.
Bratness, I'm talking about the Hunger But Mainly Death Games.
The Hunger But Mainly Death Games. Wow, I somehow forgot about them in the last few minutes. What's going on with me today? Whatever it is, it's probably another sign that I'm not going to be picked. Greta, there's no use dwelling on it, I tell him. This is what every teenager has to go through, even if they live in some crazy alternate universe without death tournaments. Even then, the things adults do to them are just as bad, like not letting them have co-ed sleepovers or asking them to go get the mail.
We could do it, you know,
he says, pacing faster. What are you talking about?
We could jam a lightning rod into a barrel of toxic waste and put it in the graveyard and hope that it makes an army of zombies to kill the adults. Forget it, he shouts. It's obviously too deep and complicated for you to understand.
Then, with a flourish, he throws his black velvet cape across his face and turns his back to me. Have it your way, I say. But come on, let's go hunt. We walk out to the old hollow tree where we conceal our weapons. Which one will I use today? Bazooka? Antimatter ray? Poison grenade launcher? Man, I love hunting. All the weapons in the tree were my father's. He found them down in the mines and taught me how to use them. He knew it was the only way to make sure I'd be safe from my mother if he died.
Bratness, before we start,
he said on our first training day,
I want you to know that your mother loves you very much, in her own special way. Unfortunately, that way is trying to murder you, because she's batshit crazy. So grab hold of this attack chainsaw, and let's begin.
To some, it might have been a sad moment. I was overjoyed. That may sound cold, but when I was a toddler, this was one of my lullabies. Rock-a-bye, Bratness, in your safe cage. These bars will protect you when Mommy's enraged. If she should break through them, don't have any fear. I made a machine that shoots tranquilizer darts at her if she gets too near. Of course, hunting is illegal here. But if it's a choice between that and starving to death, I'll take hunting every time. Especially since starving to death is also illegal, and the punishment is painful, lethal injection. Anything that makes our capital city, big, huge, nice capital city, look bad is a treasonous crime. Even saying our country's name out loud is punishable by death. Pandum. Sort of a crappy name, right? But the reason the capital, I'm just going to call it the capital from here on out, both for length reasons and because not every name in a parody book can be a pun, chose it is all too clear, according to their Wikipedia page. We, the most advanced city in the world, called on our greatest minds to devise the best name for our perfect country. If they chose something so remarkably stupid, imagine how dumb that makes you. You're so stupid that you would have probably called it Poopy Town. Yep, that's how stupid you are. So obviously you're too dumb to ever stand up for yourselves or make us stop killing your children. You know, all this talk of the hunger but mainly death games is making me wonder what it would be like to kill a person, I say. I'm not sure I could do it.
I have a feeling you'd be fine, Greta replies. You just killed a family of squirrels with a single ninja star.
But killing a person is different.
You just picked up a venomous snake, swung it around to break its spine, and used it to lasso another snake, and now you're eating that snake raw.
True enough. But all the same, something inside me whispers that if I ever had to turn my mustard gas gun on a person, I simply wouldn't be able to. Mustard gas costs upwards of one wood chip. No way I'm paying that much to kill only a single human being. After a while, we decide we've caught enough for one day. I look over my catches happily. I've bagged enough kills to keep my family eating raccoon gallbladders all winter. And because today is no ordinary day, Greta and I decide to reward ourselves. Why not? We may never get the chance to eat an entire fresh hornet's nest again.
And may the odds, he begins, mocking Pandum's official slogan for the games,
make it true that when you're mortally wounded in an excruciatingly painful way, your body goes into shock and you don't feel anything as you die. I finish. It's not particularly encouraging, but it is realistic. Before we head off to school, we decide to see if we can get anything for our haul at the Blob, which is a semi-conscious gelatinous creature that pulsates in the middle of the tires. Nobody knows where the Blob came from. Some say it's always been there, at least since that chemical factory leaked into the Slum 12 retirement village. All I know is that when you leave a fresh kill on its membrane, sometimes it'll slide out a few gold coins. That happens about 25% of the time. The other 75%, the Blob shoots out hundreds of fanged tentacles and tries to kill us. But if you want to survive in the crack, those are the odds you have to take. There is no other choice. I mean, I guess I could always apply for a job at the supermarket. The starting salary for a checkout girl isn't half bad. In fact, it's way more than I ever get from the Blob. But that sounds way boring. Ah, tentacle! 20 minutes and 20 narrow escapes from death by digestion later, we head off to school. On our way out, we make sure to say goodbye to Garbage Sally, the Blob's wife. See ya, Garbage Sally, I call out, waving at her floating figure deep inside the Blob.
Help,
comes her tiny reply. Greta and I chuckle. It's so Garbage Sally to joke around like that. When we get to school, I notice a group of incoming freshmen clustered together, chattering nervously. Funny, when I was a freshman, I felt as if I had finally made it, as if I had become a real teenager, not just some kid who had celebrated a 13th birthday. But looking at this group, I'm astounded at how small they seem. Is that how we looked to the older kids when we were freshmen? Probably not. All three grades above us were born during famines, so they were much tinier and weaker than we were. The bell rings, and we start walking towards the doors. That's when Pig catches my eye, and what I see makes my heart stop.
Pig!
I shout.
Pig!
She glances around as if she hears something, but she doesn't see me, and continues to walk towards the doors. I break into a sprint. I must do something, or it will all be over for her.
Pig!
I exclaim, panting as I catch up to her just in time. For God's sake, fix your hair. There's a weird chunk of it standing straight up. There are some things I'll never get about little kids, and one of the biggest is why their hair sticks up in weird ways so often. It's like 4 out of the 5 school days, they'll come in with one part of their hair defying gravity like it's tied to the ceiling, and next to it is a chunk that's matted down like oily beaver fur. I'm not criticizing them. It happened to me, too. I just don't know how it's scientifically possible.
Ratness!
She hisses, her face turning bright red.
You're humiliating me!
No need to get fussy. I'll use some of my mommy magic to get it down, I say, licking my hand and stretching it out towards her.
Stop!
She cries.
I'm not a baby, Bratness!
I want to protest, but in my heart, I know she's right. Shoot, I'm sorry, Pig. It's just, you're my little sister. I guess I can be overprotective sometimes. Her frown begins to fade. Stepping forward, she wraps her arms around me and gives me a hug. I lean down to whisper in her ear. Now, I don't want to embarrass you in front of your friends, but do you want to do a quick diaper check before you go inside?
Ah!
She yells, breaking free of my grasp and running inside. The rest of us file in slowly, under the watchful eyes of the group of insane murderers the Capitol uses as a police force, the Peacekeepers, a name so blatantly ironic that they added the quotes themselves. People say that in the dark days, our school was a maximum security prison. Funny. Seems fitting, when you consider that both prisons and schools are known for serving subpar food and having group exercise yards.
All right, you worthless pieces of trash,
shouts a peacekeeper, as a thick steel gate clangs shut behind us.
Into your holding cells.
A muscle-bound guard tosses me into the barbed wire enclosure that surrounds my desk. All around me, I hear the sounds of my classmates slamming into the rough floor, crying out in pain when they accidentally brush against the wire. That cursed devil's rope, the bane of our existence. I sigh. Back to the grind.
Hey, Bratness, how was your summer?
Comes a voice to the side of me. It's Magma, the daughter of Slum 12's mayor. Her desk enclosure is right next to mine. Though we occasionally talk, I wouldn't call her a friend. As the mayor's daughter, she leads a life of luxury I can scarcely imagine. Clothes not made out of briars and tumbleweeds. A water source that only has a few dead horses in it. As a result, there's little we can connect over.
Oh, pretty good. I found a new way to scrape rotting hunks of food out of deer intestines. It makes it a lot easier to dry the stomachs and make them into a tough jerky you can gnaw on while you're hunting.
From the look on her face, I can tell I've said the exact wrong thing. The barf that comes out of her mouth is probably another indication. I struggle to think of how to smooth things over, but never get the chance. The classroom door swings open, and in walks Miss Woodruff. Tall, blonde, and dressed in impeccably pressed rags, she cuts an imposing figure.
Good morning, students. Let me be the first to say welcome back. That, and don't forget that talking out of turn will result in immediate death by sniper. Now, what do we say to the sniper for giving his time to help us learn?
Thank you, Mr. Sniper, we murmur.
Have a good year, kids,
he replies with a cheery wave, up in his watchtower. I shake my head. How anyone can feel cheery on the first day of school is beyond me. We start with history. I open my book to the first page. Like all pages of all school books in Pandum, it is nothing but the sentence, Pandum is great, over and over. I take out my pen and begin to carefully trace every word, as is required by law. Call me a nerd if you want, but it's sort of neat to realize that by the end of the year, we'll have gotten through this entire book. As we trace, Miss Woodruff relates the history of Pandum, which we've heard countless times. How it rose out of the ruined societies of the dark days to bring stability and prosperity to the entire continent.
How, eventually, the government realized that, instead of peace and stability, what people really like is evil and sadness and dying. How a group of traitors rebelled, lost, and were forced to send their children to a yearly death tournament as punishment. But suddenly, for the first time, something about it seems strange to me. So when Miss Woodruff asks if anybody has any questions, I do something that no self-respecting kid should ever do. I voluntarily ask one. The class turns and stares at me, as best they can anyway, since our neck shackles don't allow much head movement. "I don't get it," I say. "Why is that the only way?"
"I have no idea what you mean, Bratness," she says.
"Wouldn't other ways work better? Like, what if they exclusively starved us? If that's all they focused on, we'd probably be much weaker and just want to lie around on the dirt all day." She shakes her head in exasperation.
"You know as well as I do that scientists in the capital have proven that nobody ever rebels because of death tournaments. It's the fifth law of thermodynamics, for crying out loud. And you know that the rebels themselves agreed to the hunger but mainly death games when they were invited to help the capital draft a new constitution.
If that's the case, why are the parts the rebels signed filled with written-down screams of torture?"
"That was back when pens became sentient for a little while. The rebels were probably squeezing them too hard."
My blood starts to rise. This is too much. Not every adult can be as insane as my mom. Some of them must like their kids. And for them, the very idea of the hunger but mainly death games must be infuriatingly beyond belief. Especially that year when there was no food in the arena, and the only weapons were machines that let you make bacon from humans. But there's no time to dwell on it, because then the bell rings and woohoo, half day. We rush out happily and run down to the square, where the reaming is about to take place. I know it's stupid for us to be excited. We're all aware that all half days, like snow days, end in utter misery. When we reach the square, we break out into groups and have to try to assign ourselves to the correct holding pen in order of birth month, all without speaking. Then we have to get in a circle and hold hands with people across from us in such a way that we form a human knot, which we then have to untangle from without letting go of each other. Neither of these have anything to do with the reaming. They're just stupid team-building games the government makes us play in an attempt to calm us down so that the square isn't flooded with nervous pee. After that, the mayor takes the stage.
"Good afternoon, citizens,"
he says solemnly, looking out from the podium in his most formal full-body Uggs.
"Today, we celebrate Reaming Day, which is sure to become yet another shining mayonnaise emerald in the exquisite diadem that is Slum 12's history. As is customary, I will now read a list of your fellow citizens' greatest accomplishments in the games."
He pulls out two note cards and begins to read.
"First, we had a winner one time."
He moves on to his second card.
"Second, when we died the other 73 times, it wasn't always accompanied by crying and pleading. Thank you,"
he concludes.
"Now, please give your undivided attention to this message from President Satan Man."
A large screen is unfurled at the back of the stage, and the image of a silver-haired man in a neatly tailored black suit appears on it. He glares out at the audience with his piercing red eyes, softly growling.
"Greetings, Slum 12,
he begins, with a crooked sneer that exposes a row of razor-sharp steel teeth.
"Extremely evil greetings. I have one question for you all. Are you ready to die?"
I shudder. For some reason, I can't shake the feeling that there's something evil about this man. He licks his lips with his forked tongue and continues.
"You'd better be ready, for as we say in the capital, garbage men deserve a garbage death, where garbage means painful."
With President Satan Man done, the mayor calls up a short, squat woman in a garish pink wig,
with a garish living Furby growing from the side of her head.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?